I, Libertine, Chapter 10.
Miss Callow!
I've come back, she said, and showed her teeth. Her eyes were narrowed and they glittered. She was garbed in a voluminous drapery of an oriental cast and a heavy material, and ornate enough to be totally unsuitable to the time of year. On second inspection, it was, in its toga-like folds, totally unsuitable to be a garment at all.
"It's a tapestry,"
she informed him, aware of his inspection. "From the north room of Minden. The upstairs maid put it out to sun behind the stables yesterday. She must have forgotten it. Thank heaven."
We burned your clothes," he said, as the only thing he could think of to say,
which reminded him of the reason for their cremation, which brought back the earth-shaking, petal-shriveling, light-bending miasma, which in turn made it clear to him that he recognized the odor not exclusively in memory. Miss Callow still smelt like the midden of an almshouse.
"Ah, clothes,"
she said disdainfully, and before he could shriek, stop, she shrugged her shoulders and let the heavy folds fall to her waist.
"Look,"
she said breathlessly.
"Look at me."
He averted his eyes.
"Miss Callow, please."
"Look, look," she said insistently. "In art, modesty has no place, nor in nature, nor in science."
She drew a deep breath.
"Nor in science, I say. Look, 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 look what you've done to me."
So he looked, and absorbed first the fact that she was neither bird nor reptile. But this was generality. His second observation was that the skin affliction on her face was indeed repeated on her body, as Meadows had reported, though it was slight and looked harmless. It was also uncured.
"It's wonderful,"
she said, closing her eyes ecstatically.
"Isn't it wonderful?"
"I suppose it is,"
he said inanely.
"What is wonderful?"
"Well, you know, the hair,"
she said hardily. Art, science, or natural philosophy to the contrary. Hair was to her an improper word when describing anything below the earlobes.
"I don't see any hair," he said bluntly.
"Yes, isn't it wonderful?"
And then he understood.
"Meadows!"
he bellowed.
"Meadows!"
"Yes?"
said the window timidly. He looked and saw the top of Meadows' head down to the eyebrows protruding above the sill.
"Come here, Meadows. Hurry."
The head rose slowly and steadily, as if floated in a filling bowl, until the eyes were discovered.
"My word!"
it said faintly, and then disappeared again.
"Half a moment,"
said Lance to the governess, flung out of the laboratory and collared Meadows, who was scuttling pell-mell toward the footbridge.
"Come back. Hang it all."
"She'll put out my eyes,"
wailed Meadows.
"I will if you don't come. Cheer up, old chap. It's all right."
He walked the reluctant alchemist back into the laboratory, where, faced with a vision which stood in the center of the room, like some mad variation of a new classicism, Meadows put his eyes and his fists on Lance's shoulder blades, and they approached her like a quadruped.
"Ah, Mr. Meadows, look, look at me,"
coaxed Miss Callow, making it even more unavoidable. Meadows peeked, ducked, rose, peered, and then at last set aside his human screen and frankly examined his specimen.
"Oh, I do say, Courtney, this is extraordinary. No hair, what?" "It's a miracle,"
said Miss Callow.
"Magic, look here."
She turned her head and put back her side locks. She had a bald spot as broad as a hand on the back of her head.
"Even here. Not that I mind. My fault, really. I wasn't helping. You and dear Lance are the two most tactful gentlemen I've ever met."
Lance had thought himself beyond shock, but this proved him wrong.
"We are what?"
"That's like you. Modest, too. You knew all along you couldn't mention such a thing as my... as all that, well, my hair. You knew so much better than I what would help and how to go about it. Is it? Do you know if it's all for good? Do you imagine?
Lance and Meadows met one another's eyes.
Meadows shrugged. Perhaps not, Lance translated. But Meadows can make up more for you, if you ever... I say, Meadows, you can make up more.
I certainly, jolly well positively... I don't really know, said Meadows. I say, she... That is, it does smell a bit, doesn't it?
Come along with me, Miss Gallo. I'll have Johnson sluice you down. She did wonders with the bedroom walls this morning.
Miss Gallo started to follow him, almost stumbled on the dragging ends of her drapery, and brought them up over her shoulders, with, Lance thought, some reluctance. He squired her into the kitchen and gave explicit instructions to Johnson, whose eyes and nostrils vied with one another for the most expansion while he talked. He left them and returned to the laboratory, where Meadows was already at work mixing.
"Jolly good job, Meadows. What's in the filth, the stuff, anyway?"
"A lot of things," said Meadows abstractedly, clearing off a bit of bench space with a sweep of his forearm. "I've a bit left from the bottom of this bowl."
He raised the lid of the bowl, and Lance sprang and pressed it down with both hands.
"Well, do you suppose we could work up some more and keep track and write out a receipt? So much of this, so much of that."
"If you'd like."
"I would like. Meadows, my boy, you have discovered how to turn rancid goose grease into gold. If you can get that receipt, we'll hire somebody to put it up for us in little round boxes and sell it in the apothecary shops for 2 shillings an ounce."
"I say, what a lark."
"Well then, call it a lark if you will, but do it. I'll take care of all the trading part and share with you, say, 20% to 80%.
"I wouldn't think of taking such a share," said Meadows. "Not from you, my dear chap."
"You deserve it. After all, you invented it."
"I couldn't have without you, though."
"I can't argue money with you, old man,"
Lance said warmly, wondering if he could hold the fool at 75.
"We'll just make mine 10%. I say, I must open this flask of Oxbust now, and I rather think you won't care for it."
Lance retreated, exultant.
So was launched one of the happiest periods of Lance Courtney's life. 5 quietly eventful years, which began with the receipt of a letter from Beasley, enclosed in a heavy packet of half banknotes, the government-approved method of sending currency to foil the highwayman. "Mr. Lance Captain Courtney, dear sir, herewith my warmest compliments and the enclosed id est £400 in banknotes, duly halved, the rest dispatched by post rider to Mr. Worthington of Westerham, the which I understand is within the hour's ride from your holding. Mr. Gerald Worthington is apprised of your coming and in possession of a description of you, a tracing of your signature in hand, and a receipt on which I trust you will make your mark and return to me, by which you will have deduced, my dear sir, the successful conclusion of our enterprise. Having submitted her complaint against Mr. Augustus John Hervey to the ecclesiastical court, Milady Chudley did thereupon swear unto her spinsterhood. Mr. Hervey, who was there present, did accept the censure of said court in good part, and gave his word that he would henceforth and forever cease and desist from the repetition of the offence, to wit, boastfully and groundlessly, publishing as a fact a relationship now held in view of said oath to be a nullity. Milady and the good Evelyn Pierpont entered into matrimony on the 17th instant, and on the 18th did embark for Calais, accompanied by Miss Axelrood, who at our last meeting sent you her affectionate regards. Please remember my suggestion concerning a chair for you in my offices, should such activity appeal to you at any future time. It has been edifying and pleasant to be, and is to remain. Your servant, Sir Bugley Beasley."
It was Lance's Midas phrase. Everything he touched showered him with success. Evelyn Meadows departed to the Institute production facilities for what was nearly called "My Darling Courtney Hair and Stubble Ointment for Gentlemen and Ladies," a christening suggestion by Miss Callow and approved by Meadows.
by which at length reached the market as Milady Hetzibah's salve, a hound to the hares, when Miss Callow was at length convinced that Lance, as young country gentleman, could not afford to be connected publicly with a proprietary toiletry. Miss Callow left her post and followed Meadows to London, partly because of her idolatry, and partly to be near a source of supply, for she grew hair at an amazing rate. She became so anxious with the success of the enterprise that she took it upon herself to represent in the back rooms of apothecaries all over the county of London, where in the interest of science she exhibited her calculated pattern of pilation and depilation to startled shopkeepers. She was indeed one of the happiest happenstances of those 5 years. For example, when Evelyn Meadows fled to America, she took over the Miss Hetzibah business and trebled it in a month. For all her pique at Lance, who had arranged, through Sir Gregory, the position of collection officer in the tax office in Boston, so that Meadows could be kept out of trouble while his cousin Charles cooled down, Cousin Charles had come bursting out of Milan looking for Evelyn's ears to box, for having been idling in the Downs while their inheritance was snapped out from under them by the infamous Miss Chudley. He even came to Featherfront looking for Evelyn without success. He was a precise little man who affected linen without a pleat, a ruffle, or a single seam more than it took to hold it together. He left a message for Evelyn to the effect that if their uncle predeceased the new countess and left her with all the money to spend, he, Charles, would flay him, Evelyn, with a shoehorn, even if it took a week. He then returned to Milan. Wonderful years. There was what came to be known as the hobby. Perhaps it was Beasley who caused it, through the letter he got from Lance acknowledging the £400 in which he thanked the barrister and declined his offer.
I am interested in the law only as it piques my curiosity, and should be considered as a collector thereof.
Or perhaps Barrowbridge, in drafting the letter for him, secretly hoped for such a result. However it came about, Lance gained a small, highly select, and quiet reputation for being able to come up with the most enterprising solutions for knotty problems at law, and an avoidance thereof.
Astonishing chap, the young bloods and the fish and staff would tell one another. Get into a tacky patch, tip off old Lance, let him buzz off to the hills and ruminate a bit, and the next thing you know, he's come up with the kind of answer nobody expects. Especially if you didn't expect any answer at all. And know what? By Jove, you can't give him a penny for it. He won't accept it.
You couldn't give him a penny for it. But you might find out he needed another horse. He might sportingly be intrigued in an investment in a spice ship. Any profits to be taken in his name, any losses to be borne by grateful old you. You might be able to divine the name of his tailor, and somehow think of dropping around and paying the fellow, to give old Lance a pleasant surprise when next he came to the city. Perhaps you'd visit him in his little diggings in the Downs, and find him wistful about the scratchy condition of his grounds, and send over your gardener and some helpers from your manse for a week or two. Such a decent chap, you wondered how he ever made the connections he did. Want some neat and necessary surgery with a knitting needle? He knew a woman in Bermondsey who want to sell off a stiff bit of silver plate until the governor comes through in the next quarterly? Lance could steer you to a chap in Cheapside who'd give you a decent price without a word, and you'd know the stuff would never be seen in England again. And where he shone was in the dustiest reaches of law.
Mr. Barrowbridge, he said one evening after his return from London, I met a chap at Drury Lane who's in a bit of a stew. It seems he's married.
I can't help him, said Barrowbridge sleepily.
As time went on, he slept more, though the sleep was lighter. He was approaching a condition of perpetual light trance, a constant drowse through which his mind flickered and flashed like summer lightning.
He's Oswald Marriott, the French brandy chap. Got two castles and a racecourse of his own.
We can help him,
Barrowbridge said immediately.
What saddened him?
This marriage of his. Third wife, you know. He's afraid his second wife will find out about it.
And charge bigamy, what? I presume there's a first wife, too, somewhere.
Not any more. She just died. Her relations feel she should have more of an estate out of it. They're the ones who are hinting at telling the second wife about the third wife.
Barrowbridge frowned while his mind tested, turned, threaded, and reviewed the information.
That's not bigamy, lad. That's trigonometry. Who's the second wife? Where does she come from?
I think he said her mother was married to his Uncle Oswald.
Barrowbridge's eyes opened abruptly.
Really? I say, how tidy do you suppose their marriage records are?
Not very, I imagine. He's only recently made his pile, though nobody's actually village folk.
Do tell your Mr. Marriott, said Barrowbridge, that if he can arrange things so that he changes places in the records with his uncle of the same name, his troubles are over.
Over? How?
Why, by an honest accident, unbeknownst to himself, you might say. His second wife is his niece. Now that's within the prohibited degree. And though the marriage isn't void, it's readily voidable, and on record too, without her knowledge or appearance. Get him to a good barrister and have that done.
Very well, but wouldn't it call attention to his bigamy?
Not if he brought the action to void. Ignorance of consanguinity is a defense. It's being his action makes it good faith. They'll void it.
I'm sorry, sir. I still don't understand how voiding that marriage solves his problem.
Lad, I'll spell it out for you. His dead wife's relations can't bring charges for bigamy when his second wife is a nullity.
Oh, I see. And what about the third marriage? He was married to her while the second marriage existed.
But the second marriage never existed. Once it's been voided.
What about the third marriage in regard to the first?
The first one's dead, Lanky. Do go tell Marriott instantly to become his own uncle. Slide me that chamber pot, will you, lad?
And so, when the liberated Mr. Marriott found out that Lance did not have a cellar large enough for the cases of fine brandy he wished to give him, he dug him one. One of the pleasantest things about the hobby was the good relations Lance set up with the lawyers. He never missed an opportunity to send the people involved to the lawyers, virtually never solved any but the most simple problems with advice alone. As a result, lawyers cultivated him, added to his collection of uncommon law, and in general made things as happy for him as they could. Beasley early became one of his staunchest and most voluble admirers.
"Chap practically a beardless youth," he would say at the club, "and things like a Lord Advocate. You'd think he'd been at the bar for 50 years.
Splendid years they were. There was Minden, Sir Gregory, Elaine. Despite the fact that he associated with the little baronet primarily for his position and influence, however limited, he was not immune to the man's surprisingly deep enthusiasm for the immense history he was compiling. Sir Gregory read Latin and Greek with familiarity, and French as if he had been born to it. And many a literary and historical tag Lance carried away with him, to be hoarded and flashed briefly as the circumstances offered itself in London. That is, the presence in a gathering of just the right level of folk who could be and should be impressed by a young man's scholarly attributes, and the absence of scholars. Yet at times he came away bemused, for the moment oriented in the swell and the change of culture against culture, the pressure of Rome against the world around her, the pinching off of the Parthians and the explosive rise of the Sassanian Persians, which, with the ambition of the Teutonic tribes, Sir Gregory held responsible for the dissolution of the Roman Empire, despite its power in subsequent centuries. These spells of identification with history and humanity were transient but heady, and Lance confirmed in his belief that Sir Gregory was a great, if unimportant, little man, whose history of Rome would be, if nothing else, a phenomenon like a stone column in a desert, useless in itself but a good deal more than other men could boast of. Elaine became a lady. Her eyes and hair grew brighter and her figure ripe. In one way only did she not change, and that was only because it was initially a state of completeness. Her devoted constancy to Lance, isolated as she was with her sisters and a series of genteel tutors, she had no opportunity to acquire fashionable guiles and tactics. no wish or need for them. She loved Lance openly and wholeheartedly. It was one of those rare affections seen sometimes in the religious recluse, the artist and the scholar, wherein to love is sufficient, to be loved inconceivable. Indeed, her emotions for Lance fed her quite as adequately as her father's engrossment in dead Italians fed him. Lance struck a posture of grave regard when he was with her, and permitted no peaks in this particular plateau. He had brief moments of regret that her father was such a small baronet and his holdings so unimpressive, else this might have been one of the great loves of the period. Sir Gregory permitted him unlimited freedom with the girl, perhaps sensing Lance's attitude, perhaps in his preoccupations, genuinely unaware he might be expected to do otherwise. Bella and Barbara likewise blossomed. Each had her extremes of passion for Lance, each more than once. But this was a game, part of the atmosphere, and there were no questions in their minds as to whose property he was. During those years there were disappointments for Lance, but in the long run they served only to etch in the finer shadows and put his greater contentment in perspective. Chief among those shadows was a perpetual and nagging pique at the new Countess of Kingston and her ward, Miss Axelrood, which became inflamed after 1773, when the Duke died. Completely overlooking the handsome remuneration he had already received, he began to believe he had been had, that his entire aim in the operation had been to secure the implied promise that they would see to it he was circulated about, placed next to the mighty, and even given entree at court. The continued residence abroad of the Kingston menage made this impossible, and although he kept up his visits to Blanton House and a few others of that ilk, his acquaintance in the city did not expand very much. Barrowbridge was, of course, no longer in a position to pressure and graymail him into high society. All things considered, these were years of consolidation, of retrenchment, wherein he became far more the country gentleman and less the man about town. His salve enterprise throve, and his income from it increased, even after he halved his interest by the sale of manufacturing rights to an apothecary in Soho, who had married Miss Callow primarily out of a desire to retain for himself the displays of the salve's effectiveness. It was rumored that he executed in a mezzo relevo of skin and hair a magnificent St. George and dragon on her back and hips, but Lance was content to relegate this to fancy and eschewed his privilege, unquestionable even now, to see for himself. In the fall of 1775, which marked Lance's fifth season at Featherfront, he returned from Minden one evening to find a dusty horse with the reins over its head clomping unforgivably about on the bowling green. His occasional man, Hicks, had gone for the post, and there was apparently no one about but Johnson, who had always expressed herself terrified of horses. Cursing and grumbling, Lance captured the animal and led it to the stable yard, where he tethered it. Returning to the front of the house, he rounded the corner by the bayberry bush, and was confounded by the explosion, as if out of the ground, of a leaping, yelling figure, wearing a long headdress of brilliantly dyed feathers, leathern leggings, which left the buttocks bare, and a fringed buckskin shirt. This apparition brandished a small, long-handled, and apparently very sharp axe, and with its other hand cupped over its shrieking mouth, created a wavering ululation so shocking in effect that Lance's leap upward threatened his very shoe-buckles. He staggered back into the zinnia bed and put his shoulders against the house lest he fall into a faint, and stood there awaiting death. His mouth was dry, his lips drew back and twitched against his upper teeth. He stopped breathing. The nightmare creature bounded about in a large semicircle, pounding its mouth, pounding its chest, waving the tomahawk aloft, and plunging it into the ground, cutting great gobbets out of the already damaged green, and arriving at last face to face with Lance, axe raised for its terminal coup. It was a tableau for a horrid, frozen instant, And then the Red Indian said,
"Oh, I say, old chap, I mean, don't smile at me like that. You make me feel absolutely contemptible."
"Meadows!"
"I mean, I should jolly well have known I couldn't make you turn a hair, Watt, not you."
"What the devil are you doing in that? Outlandish! The deuce do you mean by chopping up my bloody bowling green? Tie up your ruddy horse. Where did you come from, anyway?"
It all burst from Lance with apparent simultaneity, and the savage figure backed away from the torrent, fluttering his hands uselessly in front of him. The tomahawk, fastened to his wrist by a thong, slipped from his fingers and swung down and gashed his thigh.
"Oh, I say, this bloody thing's all bloody!"
he whimpered, separating the cut edges of legging and flesh. Again there was a tableau as they stared at one another, and suddenly they were pounding each other on the back.
"I say, it is good to see you. Whatever in the world? Why didn't you write to me?"
"Come in, damn it," said Lance. "No, wait. Can you show thee that dance again?"
"Rather good, Watt, but I am bleeding a bit."
"Oh, hang the bleeding. We'll put it right in a trice. Do just show me how one of those howling savages enter a house."
The effect, even though expected, actually frightened Lance for a moment. He followed the howling, capering figure into the great hall, seeing at the far end the horrified figure of Johnson disappearing behind a slammed door. Even over the uproar Meadows was making, he could hear other doors bang in rapid succession. The kitchen, the pantry, the back kitchen, the scullery, the wood room, and finally the rear exit. He wondered how far she would get before she turned back. He was also aware of the rattling intake of breath discernible in the area of the gimlet hole, which was his reason for asking the encore. Delighted, he fell back on the settle and brought Circe's.
"Well enough, old chap. Look out, you'll have my mantle cloven. I say stop, old boy, enough."
Dripping sweat and blood and panting like a bellows, Meadows ceased, and Lance went to the kitchen to fetch water and cloth to bind him up. While he did so, Meadows, with many discursions and chronological trackings back and forth, told him of his adventures in America. It appeared that Boston, circa 1770, was not what he and Sir Gregory and Lance had thought, at least not for a crown tax collector.
"Place is positively seething. I mean, chaps rushing about burning MPs in effigy and that sort of thing. Politeness doesn't count a bit, you know. After all, one's just doing one's duty. But the very nicest people are likely to get positively rude when one asks for taxes, even if one apologizes first."
He had stumbled along, exposing himself to a minimum of fury on the one hand from the colonists and on the other from his superiors, until he had a bright idea. His income, a fund from his uncle, the Duke of Kingston, plus his small share of the large amount paid as a royalty on the salve, and his salary, had been just sufficient to carry him in his deception for nearly 4 years. He would make his rounds, but in all but a few cases. This was purely a social act. He would then return to his office, count out what monies he had, and give them, together with doctored books, to his superiors. He was helped in this incredible charity by two factors. His predecessors had not been able to collect even this pittance, and his superiors could not understand bookkeeping. And as long as the people paid no taxes and the collectors received them, Meadows was left alone. His deception was revealed in October of 1774, when the last act of the fleeing tax commissioners was actually to throw him into the River Charles for having softened the king's hand on these rebels by leading them into non-payment of excises. There were more formal punishments in the Codex Lex, of course, but they all took time, and time was what the commissioners had not had at the moment. The Massachusetts Assembly was prorogued clean out of existence, and the hapless Meadows was, as reported, thrown into the Charles by the commissioners on their way to safety on board the anchored men of war. And if this were not tragedy enough for one night, when he paddled ashore and hauled himself, exhausted and chilled, down the riotous streets toward his lodgings, he was recognized as a tax collector by a band of patriots, who unhesitatingly carried him back and threw him into the Charles again. This time he swam out to a British frigate, where first the galley dregs were thrown upon him by accident, and next some bored, ship-bound grenadiers started potting at him with their muskets. He cried "Long live George III," until bubbles began to appear between the syllables. They at last took pity and grappled him aboard. 3 days later he was able to join an armed shore party and make his way to his lodgings to pick up his things, only to find that the looters had preceded him, and all that was left was his Indian costume. Resignedly he took it along because it was all he had to show for 4.5 years' work in the government service, and because it occurred to him that it might amuse old Lance Courtney to see it in action, and so he had come back to England, and here he was. Lance laughed unabashedly during this recital, and afterwards promised to see to it that a suit was instituted to recover the tax money he had so nobly paid for the colonists, a suggestion which threw Meadows into blind panic on the instant. No, he should let well enough alone. Why try to present records for those years and itemize those tax payments?
"It's over, old man, finished. Don't let's live it again. Besides, dear dead Uncle Evelyn's dear old Bancroft will be along in a fortnight. If I can put up with you for a day or so, I shall be all right."
"You're welcome, of course," said Lance sincerely,
thinking, "I wonder if Hepzibah will take him off my hands. I wonder if Sir Gregory can wangle something else from him. Has he no ruddy relatives?"
"What do you hear from your cousin Charles?"
"Oh, he's back on the continent. Leghorn this time. Exporting exports and importing imports and all that, which is jolly fine. Every time he hears a word about the Duchess Elizabeth, he gets livid and can't be polite. He can't even be understood. He just makes noises."
"What do you hear of her?"
"The last I heard, she was being squired about by His Holiness Pope Clement XIV. But of course he's dead now."
"Surely that isn't true."
"So they say. I don't think there was anything, you know. After all, she's going on 60, what?"
"Yes. And Miss Axelrod is still with her?"
"Always. And you don't hear any gossip about her, by Jove. I don't know just what she does, what, but she does it quietly."
Lance didn't know and said so. He did know how quietly she could get into and out of an inn, and didn't say that either. He laughed suddenly. The Red Indian made a questioning sound.
"I was just thinking that's sort of amusing, the wheels within wheels thing, Meadows. The reason you're strapped, waiting for a draft, is because the Duchess has the money. But the reason you get the money is that she doesn't get it. And it all comes from the same place."
"It's a wonder she didn't get it," said Meadows. "The way she had him buffaloed. American expression, good, what? Not that she needs it."
"Lord, no."
The Kingston fortune was large indeed, and it was by no means all in frozen assets. Lance knew a bit more than most people just how large it was. Beasley had given him a draft of the Duke's will to examine for loopholes, and he and Barrowbridge had fine-toothed it, curried it down, and delivered it shining. It was as final as the last trump. He laughed again. It had been Barrowbridge's exclusive idea to continue Charles and Evelyn Meadows' settlements and quarterly income as heirs apparent, but for the Duchess. They might be angered if she got the bulk of the estate and let them, but they might be dangerous if they got nothing. As for the other clause, that the Duchess would inherit the estate and keep it only so long as she did not remarry, that too was Barrowbridge's idea, he knowing full well that the Duchess would so present it that it would appear to be a concession. Actually, he could not imagine a circumstance which would make that extraordinary woman happier than to be hugely wealthy, free to go where she wished, do what she cared to do, and be forbidden to marry. But at the moment, Evelyn Meadows was his problem.
"I say, you may know that dear old Hepzibah's married?"
"Yes, I've heard. Who is the lucky chap?"
"A fellow named Suano, Portuguese or some such, an apothecary. Interested in sculpture, too, I've heard."
"Sculpture? Oh, I say. I always wanted to try my hand at sculpture."
"Evelyn, you're a very funny fellow sometimes.
said Lance, hardly able to contain himself.
"We'll ride up to the city tomorrow. I say, you do have some other clothes now."
"Oh, yes,"
said Meadows, touching his great train of feathers. "These are just extras." So Lance took him to the city, and indeed it was an excellent idea. Not only did Hetzibah take Meadows in, but it was all Lance could do to keep her from adding him to her household as well. It took all day, but at last he laughingly pried himself away, stopped laughing as the door closed, looked at the sky, and then at his watch, and decided to ride home that very evening. And thus he rode into his destiny. It happened some hours later, a mile along the bridle path from the Tatsfield Road, had happened to him as it happened to travellers all over England. The shadow detached itself from the loom of dark between the poplars and became the outline of a horseman.
"Stand," it said roughly, "and deliver."
Lance's mouth went dry. His lips skinned back from his teeth and made a subtle quiver. His horse stood in shadow as deep as the highwayman's. Had he been 10 feet back or 10 feet further, he would have been in pale moonlight. He couldn't be seen. The highwayman said, unmistakably cocking a horse pistol,
"I'll not shoot thee, Lanky, me lad, if thee'll talk to me. Walk me away once more, and so help me God and the cross, you're a dead man, and there'll be two of us, for I'm dead already."
When he could, and it was a long, tense time before he could, Lance cried,
"Piggott? Piggott, is that really you?"